Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
There's been an awakening of the population, and I think there's a significant change worldwide.
Democracy in focus. First, a conversation with one of the last of the civil rights warriors, former Mayor Andrew Young, on his extraordinary life, fighting for equality then and now. Plus,
the picture for journalists and journalism is pretty grim.
Press freedom under attack. I speak to Jody Ginsburg, new head of the Committee to Protect Journalists, and to NYU journalism professor Jay Rosen about the war on truth around the world. Then, China under scrutiny with the eyes of the world on the Beijing Olympics. Uyghur advocate and human rights attorney Rehan Assat fights for her brother, who she says was disappeared. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London, and tonight we return to our focus on democracy under increasing threat around the globe, from the assault on voting rights in the United States to the worldwide attacks on journalists and on press freedoms. First, the ongoing struggle for civil rights in America. And my first guest, Andrew Young, fought closely beside Martin Luther King Jr., John Lewis, and all those on the front lines for equality. He'll be 90 years old in a few weeks, and here's how the National Archives describes an American treasure. A pastor who spread the practice of nonviolence in the rural South at the risk of being killed. An activist who participated in the most pivotal acts of protest for the suffrage of African Americans, a man who witnessed the assassination of his friend who would become the everlasting symbol for civil rights, a politician and diplomat who successfully transitioned his stance for human rights into an international campaign. And Andrew Young, former congressman, ambassador to the UN, and mayor of Atlanta, joins me from his home city. Ambassador Andrew Young, welcome to our program.
Thank you very much.
So, look, I couldn't help but notice when I did a whole load of reading about you and that it is the Olympics in China right now, that you, as a young man, were really athletic. You even were training to try to take part in the 1952 Olympics. Honestly, you could have blown me down with a feather. Tell me all about that and why it didn't come to be.
Well, I actually started being an Olympic fan at 4 years old. I lived on the corner in New Orleans, 50 yards from where I was born, was the headquarters of the Nazi Party. And my father, explaining to me white supremacy, said that it's a sickness, and you don't have to worry about that. You know that God made of one blood all the nations of the earth. And he said, you never get upset with sick people, and you never let them get you upset. And he took me to see Jesse Owens in the movie Tone News in a segregated theater. But the message he got across was that when Jesse won the 100 meters, Hitler walked out rather than presenting him with his medal. And he said, the message that you should always remember is, don't get mad, get smart. That stay calm, stay cool. He said, you're not going to be able to beat up everybody, but if you stay calm, your mind can help you deal with any situation you find yourself. And so that's sort of where I got the Olympic bug. It was in New Orleans, and I was not allowed to compete in the events for young people who were white. And so I spent my life knowing that I could run faster than anybody in town. I never had a chance till I got to college. And I was in theological seminary. And the conference superintendent called and said that I need somebody to go to a little church in Marion, Alabama. And I said, well, I'm scheduled to go to New York for the summer, and I have a job, and I'm going to train with a Pioneer Track Club for the 52 Olympics. And he said, well, everybody wants to go to New York, and everybody wants to go to the Olympics. And whether you go or not, they'll have an Olympics, and they'll get along in New York. He said, but if you don't go to Marion, Alabama, we will lose a church.
Wow. So you went, you became a pastor, and kind of the rest is history, because that led to your incredible civil rights work. So let's just start a little bit at the beginning. Where did you start to learn about nonviolence? Because that was your and Dr. King's philosophy. But you were surrounded by violence of the white majority against the black community.
Well, you know, the little town that I went to with that church, the first place I went, the young lady who in the house had a Bible, and I looked at it, and it was underlined, and it was all the passages on nonviolence. Mm. And then she had a senior life-saving certificate on the wall, and I'd been on the swimming team, too, and a basketball letter. And so before I met her, I decided I must have been sent here to marry this woman. And that's the way it turned out. She was in a college. Actually, she and Coretta King went to the same high school in Marion, Alabama. And a Quaker couple arranged for them to go to college in different colleges, but they were both peace-oriented colleges. I started reading the Quaker literature on nonviolence.
You know, obviously you became friends with Dr. King. You were there in that motel when he was assassinated. You've seen violence all over the world. So I guess after all the years that you've been involved in this peaceful struggle, do you believe that it works, that it's still a worthwhile, or rather a practical, pragmatic way of getting your rights? Because, you know, John Lewis getting beaten over the head, you were there on the Selma Bridge.
I got beat up too, but yeah. That's sort of, the amazing thing to me was after I got beat up by 200 and some Klansmen, I didn't even have a headache. I continued to march through because I was concerned basically that it was the women and children I was trying to protect. I think that my time with Jimmy Carter at the UN proved that, to me, that we were able to reconcile the differences in the Panama Canal. He did a magnificent job with Begin and Sadat in Camp David. And I think if Jimmy Carter had been reelected, we would have done a new relationship with Iran, because I was in the middle of the negotiations trying to get the hostages out of Iran. But another 4 years, and I think we could have changed the world.
Let me just ask you this question, because, you know, Jimmy Carter was the first American president who brought peace between Israel and an Arab nation, obviously Egypt at Camp David. And that was an electrifying moment. I mean, it was just an electrifying moment. And then you, though, as ambassador to the UN, you thought you were doing your bit for the administration to try to figure out the more tricky bit between the Palestinians and the Israelis. You met with the PLO. It wasn't US policy, and you were forced to resign. I wonder if you fast forward today.
It was.
And you see there's still no peace, and nobody's talking to the Palestinians. Yeah.
No. Well, but before I met with the Palestinians, I had met with, actually it was in Harry Belafonte's home. He had Shimon Peres to dinner and invited me over, and we spent 4 hours talking about how I could help Israel deal with the Palestinian question. And then later on, I met with Moshe Dayan, and it was only after that. And I was trying to get them to put it off to give us time to reconcile some of the things that Israel was hoping for and that the Palestinians actually said they were agreeing to. But it couldn't be done in the UN. It had to be done in face-to-face talks.
You mentioned Moshe Dayan. You mentioned Shimon Peres. Moshe Dayan obviously was the defense minister in Israel. Shimon Peres held a number of posts, including foreign minister and prime minister. So you were right in the middle of all that. I just want to know what you think that all these decades later, there is still no peace between Israel and the Palestinians.
Well, I think that's why I kind of decided that I had to come back to Atlanta and deal with Atlanta because the international situation was far too complicated at that time. And our country was not ready to be as flexible and creative as Jimmy Carter was and as I was trying to be. We found a level of flexibility in the world that I still feel that way. There's almost no place I go where I haven't been well received and where I haven't been able to find some common ground where we could start to talk about something. And so I'm not at all cynical about the world in which we live. This is fear and neglect on our part.
Okay.
And I think one thing you learn about nonviolence is you have to overcome your fear and insecurity towards your opponent.
Okay, that's really interesting from your perspective. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I ask you, because you raised the issue of Harry Belafonte, and of course, the great civil rights activist as well as artist, and you say that he was practically single-handedly responsible for you running for Congress. How did that happen? How did he help you make that happen?
Well, the last meeting I had with Martin Luther King and Harry Belafonte was in New York just before Martin went to Memphis. And we were talking about how to get the energy of the civil rights movement into politics. And when we closed down about midnight and Harry went home, Martin said, I said, you need to get a good night's sleep. And he said, no, I'm going to catch the 6 o'clock plane in the morning to Memphis. And of course, he never left Memphis, you know, that's where he was killed. But the last conversation we had with him and Harry and me was about politics. I transferred that into, I wanted to find three congressmen to run in Savannah, Atlanta, and Birmingham. And I was going to run the campaigns. And nobody wanted to run. It was kind of dangerous. I mean, Malcolm X had been killed, Martin had been killed, John Kennedy had been killed. I mean, politics wasn't a safe profession. And Harry just said, well, it looks like you got to run. And I said, no, not me. And he said, well, nobody else wants to run, and you believe in what Martin said? And I said, yeah, I do. He said, you got to run.
Ambassador Young, let me ask you something. When you recall all of these amazing moments and you see how so much progress has been made in the United States, but with it has come backlash. So we get the first black president in Barack Obama. Then you have a backlash. You have Donald Trump. You have populism. You have more and more divisiveness. You know, fast forward to the death in police custody of so many black Americans, including most famously recently George Floyd. And it's all roiling again. Where do you see the struggle that you spent
It's not. It's not broiling again. It never stopped. I mean, I grew up in New Orleans, and I would say the kind of thing that we've had this last year, we had throughout my life. We just didn't know about it. There were 60 bombings of homes in Birmingham in 1959 and 60. And it didn't appear even in the Atlanta papers 100 miles away. And that's why Martin Luther King decided to go to Birmingham to start a movement there, because, well, we didn't have the kind of television we have now. We didn't have cell phones. And the difference is now we know what's going on, and we have people who can take pictures with their cell phones while it's going on. And so I think there's been an awakening of the population, and I think there's a significant change worldwide. Now, it doesn't mean that we've resolved the issue, but it means that we are making constant progress. And we talk about what Joe Biden has not done, but for instance, he's appointed more black judges in his first year than all the presidents put together up to him.
So what would you say, Ambassador Young, if you could talk to the Supreme Court right now, and he has promised to put a black justice or nominate a black justice to the Supreme Court, a woman? And yet, and let me just read this to you, this week, the conservative majority there let stand an Alabama congressional map that blatantly discriminates against black voters. You know, that's a big issue, this constant effort to suppress black voters.
But that was what we had to deal with in 1965, and we dealt with it. And the voting rights bill that we passed in 1965, the Republicans renewed under George Bush, and 97 senators voted for it. So we're not talking about, we're talking about democracy.
You are turning 90. You're amazing. You're turning 90 March 12th. And I interviewed Mavis Staples not so long ago. And I understand that one of the songs that she recorded and her family recorded has particular significance to you. It's called This May Be the Last Time. And I'm going to play a little clip. I heard that you were singing along. That's fantastic. Of course, she was so great in the civil rights movement.
That was something we used to sing in the middle of the civil rights movement, because almost every time we went out on a demonstration, we knew we could possibly not come back. But we continued to go, and I've made it to almost 90. I remember Martin Luther King saying that, look, we are, and he called us, he said, you know, we are a bunch of clinically insane individuals. And he said, nobody in their right mind would think that here we are, 15, 20 people, all of us under 30, under 40. And he said, you got to be sick to think that with no money and only the resources we have in our minds and souls and spirits that we can change this nation. And he said, we might not make it to 50, but if we make it to 50, we got to make it to 100, because it's going to take 100 years or so to get this country right. And we were changing America bit by bit, and we were changing the world bit by bit. There's another song that we used to sing, I Don't Feel No Ways Tired. We've come too far from where we started from. And nobody told us that the way would be easy, but I don't believe he brought us this far to leave us.
That is beautiful. What a wonderful way to end this conversation. Congressman, Ambassador, Mayor, Civil Rights Leader, Andrew Young, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Now, journalism is a fundamental pillar of democracy and human rights, and yet crackdowns, manipulation, and surveillance of the press are even more evident right now, at the Beijing Olympics, for instance, and around the Russia-Ukraine tensions. The most visibly audacious attack in recent years happened last year, when a commercial plane forced to land by Belarusian authorities did so only for them to remove and arrest a prominent opposition journalist. The number of imprisonments and deliberate killings continue to rise, and I spoke to the incoming president of the Committee to Protect Journalists, Jody Ginsburg, and to the journalism professor Jay Rosen to assess these threats. Welcome, Jay Rosen and Jody Ginsburg, and let me start by saying congratulations to you, Jody, for becoming the new executive director of the CPJ, the Committee to Protect Journalists. Let me just start out first with you then, because the latest statistics are somewhat discouraging. There are 293 journalists imprisoned by the end of 2021 and 66 journalists missing. There are at least 27 journalists killed and another 18 other journalists, you know, dying in some murky circumstances, and most recently, another several from Mexico. So, Jody, when you look at those stats, what do they tell you about the state of our profession around the world?
What they tell me is the picture for journalists and journalism is pretty grim. And it's clear that the decline in press freedom, the threats to journalists are a symptom of a decline in democracy more generally. But quite often what we're seeing is, if you like, the journalists are the canaries in the coal mine. Threats against journalists, the killings of journalists, the imprisonment of journalists often is a flag for democratic backsliding. We often see that as a precursor to increased violence more generally. And journalism is so key, it's so central, it's a pillar of our democracy, it's a pillar of free societies, and we need to be protecting journalists. And all too often what we're seeing is the politicians from democracies using language that you would expect of authoritarian regimes to discredit and demean journalists. And that's what's creating an environment that makes it incredibly dangerous to be a journalist. No longer is it the case that you are in danger if you're in a war zone. That used to be the case. But actually, the more recent statistics show that the majority of those killings you talk about, certainly in recent years, have been in non-conflict environments. That's really disturbing.
Right. Jay, I want to ask you what you think is, I want to say, the main reason for this backsliding in terms of safety of journalists, in terms of, you know, their ability to operate freely and fairly, not just around the world, but also in the United States. And I know that you have written about content, and I'm really interested in the content and whether that is part of what we're seeing. You say the news system isn't really designed for public understanding. It's designed to produce new content every day. Describe what you mean about that and how it falls into this particular threat.
Well, the simple example of what I mean is when public opinion polls show how little people know about some essential issue that's talked about in the news all the time, journalists don't say, take responsibility for that. They don't say, well, we're not doing a very good job because people don't know about it. Instead, they point to what they published about it. And that is normally a pretty good defense. So we don't have a news system that tracks how well people understand the news. We don't have a news system that is built for easy understanding. Instead, it's, to coin a phrase, one damn thing after another. And that's part of the problem with our news environment today, is that it is overwhelming people in many different ways. And now we are at a further stage in the development of that, where we have public figures, people in power, who realize that the flood of quote-unquote content can be itself a kind of manipulation. That's what Steve Bannon meant when he said to Michael Lewis several years ago, the Democrats don't matter, withdrawing from the normal contest of politics. The real opposition is the media, and the way to deal with them is to flood the zone with crap. But he used a more vivid word than crap. And this is the same method that Putin uses in Russia. There it's called the fire hose of falsehood, where instead of trying to persuade people to your point of view or even get a coherent idea across, you benefit from chaos, from too much confusion, from contradiction, from the sheer difficulty of making sense of the news. And this is a form of propaganda that is perfect for the internet age and for a world in which the cost of producing additional content is almost zero.
I think what I'm getting from both of you is that in this context that we live in right now, the assault on truth, the weaponization of the media, plus the physical assault on actual individuals is combining to produce a very dangerous situation whereby nobody actually quite knows what to believe on the one hand. And on the other hand, people are probably, you know, seeing the chilling effect of actually trying to report the truth. So, Jody, when you look at that and you think of the journalists you're trying to protect in either China or in Russia, what do you think you can do as the new executive director? What can CPJ do for those journalists who are routinely rounded up and where there's no space at all for any difference of opinion from the ruling authorities?
Well, to begin with, let me just pick up on something that Jay mentioned about this flood of dis and misinformation. And I want to be very clear that the safety of journalists and this flood of mis and disinformation are directly linked. What we see time and time again is the more that you cast doubt on individuals' trustworthiness, the more they are seen as fair game for harassment online. And what we see often is that harassment online then turns into actual physical threat and violence. And so there is a direct link between that discrediting and people's safety and security. And I don't think we talk about that enough, and we don't think we call out politicians and people of authority when they engage in that, because what they're doing is making journalists and other political figures and figures in the public eye fair game. What we as CPJ can do, and just to be clear, I haven't started yet. I don't start until April. I'm still running another organization called Internews. But one of the things I think we can do is push much harder for countries that say they believe in press freedom, in media freedom, to be much more vocal when they see other countries engaging in this kind of behavior. I think we need to see much more use of targeted sanctions against individuals in countries that are limiting press freedom. And I think we need to invest much more in supporting journalists so that they have access to digital security and other tools to enable them to defend themselves against these kinds of both verbal and physical attacks.
And Jay, I want to follow on from what you were saying about flooding the zone, and you mentioned Steve Bannon. And obviously, President Trump was a master of this. He got it from the very beginning. And right at the beginning, before he was even inaugurated, he had that famous sit-down with Leslie Stahl of 60 Minutes. And she then recounted one of the, frankly, most chilling things that he had said to her. I'm going to play this and then get you to respond.
He's attacking the press. And there were no cameras, there was nothing going on. And I said, you know, that is getting tired. Why are you doing this? You're doing it over and over and it's boring and it's time to end that. You know, you've won the nomination. And why do you keep hammering at this? And he said, you know why I do it? I do it to discredit you all and demean you all, so when you write negative stories about me, no one will believe you.
It still is the most coherent thing that I've ever heard the president say, because that's exactly true. You know, he just piled on until nobody knew what was true, what was false, what was real, what wasn't, and nobody, well, vast swathes, certainly of the American population, decided that the media was the enemy. How does one come back from that assault, Jay?
I don't think we know. And it's even worse than that chilling anecdote from Leslie Stahl suggests. It's true what he said, that part of the purpose of attacking the press was to make sure that his supporters didn't believe what journalists reported. But it's gone a step further than that, or two steps further, in the sense that now for Trump's base, which is most of the Republican Party, whether he runs or not, the mere fact that the mainstream media is reporting on something means it's something to disbelieve and oppose and erase. And so presence of a truth in the news media is itself a sign to disbelieve it. That's a step further than Leslie Stahl's anecdote. And then there's something even weirder than that and more disturbing than that, to which I've given the description verification in reverse. A verification is basic to journalism. It is what the most important thing journalists do. It's when something might be true or rumored to be true, you try to nail it down with facts, documents, witnesses, going there and seeing yourself. That's verification. Verification in reverse is when you take something that has been nailed down and you introduce doubt about it. And that doubt creates commotion and controversy and anger and backlash. And you use that energy released by the denial of factual reality and you power your political movement with it. And that's a step beyond lying, it's a step beyond, or at least different than attacks on journalists. It's a very difficult thing to counter. And this is how Donald Trump made his appearance on the political stage, is he became a birther, which was verification in reverse. So I think Leslie Stahl's story is chilling. She introduces a little bit more coherence to it than it probably had when he said it. But it's gone several steps beyond what she warned about.
And so from your perspective globally, Jody, you know, we see, and I've seen in my own reporting around the world, that in many, many autocracies, journalists, as I say, have been politicized by the system. You're either with us or you're a terrorist. That is what happens in Egypt. That's what happens in Russia. That's what happens in China in one way or another. That's the paradigm. You're either with us or you're against our country and you're a traitor. So I want you to talk about that and also how this, you know, the American state of affairs came to you. You said it was very chilling when you met some American journalists back in 2018 talking about this.
Yes. So what's really interesting about all that we've talked about is it's not just politics where this is an issue, right? It's all sorts of kinds of information. And we've seen it really clearly in the past 2 years over COVID, the number of particularly authoritarian regimes who've used COVID as a cover to introduce further emergency legislation to prevent journalists from reporting on things. We saw in Tanzania, for example, journalists were prevented from reporting any kinds of statistics that weren't produced by the government, who were essentially in denial that there was COVID at all. People weren't allowed, journalists weren't even allowed to reproduce foreign reporting. And you can imagine the effect on that. If you cannot access accurate information about healthcare, how to prevent yourself getting COVID, accurate information about vaccines, you are putting your life literally in danger. So journalists are politicized in all sorts of ways by these regimes, in ways that put potentially entire populations' lives at risk. And what I think we need to understand is that by this constant chipping away of agreements about the truth, by this constant chipping away of doubt at journalists, presenting journalists, as you say, as sort of the enemies of the people. If you're not with us, you're against us, as we've seen in Myanmar, for example, which has gone from being a country that had no journalists in jail in 2020 to being the second worst jailer of journalists in the world, largely through legislation that presents criticism of the ruling junta as treason, effectively. What we need to understand is, without those people doing that work, we as individuals do not have the access to the information that we need to lead our lives. And it's not just White House journalists, as you said, that I met who were talking about getting death threats. Increasingly, we're hearing that from people who work in local media. You talked about the journalists, the four journalists who've been killed in Mexico. The vast majority of journalists who are killed are not working internationally. They're local journalists who are incredibly vulnerable in their local communities. And what we really need to do is be supporting those local journalists much more aggressively, so that they have the financial resources, so that they have the tools to report freely and openly.
And I wonder just briefly and finally whether both of you think that social media has added to this and has really not just added, but fundamentally affected the way information is received by people, adds to the fake news, adds to the conspiracy theories, adds to, again, the weaponization of information. And whether you think, like they do in Europe, there should be regulation and control of some kind on social media. What do you think, Jody, and Jay, and then we'll wrap it up?
Look, there's no doubt that social media has made all of this so much worse. It amplifies negative content, it amplifies harassment, it amplifies hate speech, absolutely. And we've heard that time again. We heard it very powerfully from Nobel laureate, the journalist Maria Ressa, talking about the influence that Facebook and others have had in the Philippines. There's no doubt about that. I think we need to be cautious, however, though, of thinking that simply regulating the social media companies is going to be the fix for this. And in many cases, what we've seen is governments introducing so-called fake news laws or other laws to regulate social media, essentially in order to crack down on legitimate political speech. So I think we need to be extremely cautious of thinking that regulating the social media companies is going to get us out of this situation.
Jay, from your perspective, is there a way to thread that needle?
Well, I would sign on to everything Jody said, but I would add something. 95% of the conversation about misinformation and disinformation among activists, scholars, journalists, foundations, people of goodwill, focuses on the supply side, the people who are introducing it into the public sphere. Very little of our attention goes to the demand side. And we're going to have to try and understand that on a much deeper level, partly because the algorithm system that social media use, especially Facebook, but not only Facebook, is so potent in surfacing the demand for misinformation or confirmation bias, as social scientists call it. So as long as we keep treating this as a problem of supply, I don't think we're going to get there. We have to start looking into why there is such demand for bad information and the systems that turn that demand into cash and influence and political power. And it's a much more complicated problem than simply finding the bad guys and getting them to stop.
Fascinating, and obviously, you know, existential for all of us. Jay Rosen, Jody Ginsberg, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As we mentioned, the eyes of the world are on the Beijing Winter Olympics for more than just its sporting achievements. China is under intense global scrutiny for its treatment of the Muslim Uyghur population, actions the U.S. State Department has labeled a genocide. For human rights attorney and Uyghur advocate Rehan Assad, China's abuses are personal. She says her own brother was forcibly disappeared by the government and subjected to indefinite solitary confinement. She joins Hari Srinivasan to share her brother's story and why some are calling these games the Genocide Olympics.
Christian, thanks. Rehan Assad, thanks so much for joining us. When you are watching the Olympics right now, what do you want people to remember and think about?
You know, at this moment when China is being accused of committing genocide, it gets to celebrate its legitimacy as well as this wonderful game that's designed to bring the entire world together. And I don't want people to be tricked by the facade or image that the Chinese government is trying to portray, but remember what's happening behind those scenes in the dark corners of the world, where at least a million Uyghur are locked up in the concentration camps and forced labor factories and its vast prison camps, including innocent individuals like my own brother.
Tell me, for people who might still be learning about what happens to the Uyghur population in the west side of the country, what are the people there living through? What do we know as a certain fact?
At the moment, the Chinese government, under the pretext of fighting against three evils, what they call three evils, extremism, terrorism, separatism, actually cracking down on people for just simply being who they are. And that is being Uyghur, Kazakh, and their own Turkic identity. All the people who are locked up in these camps are innocent. They could be persecuted because simply being young or practicing regular religion that the Chinese government's own constitutional law allows, or just by studying abroad or having connection to a foreign country or using a WhatsApp VPN. And these are just simple methods of the Chinese government used it as an excuse to detain somebody in its broader crackdown against a race, against ethnicity. So basically, what we can conclude is that the Chinese government waged a war against a race.
You know, back in January of 2021, the State Department, Secretary Blinken, affirmed back in January that the People's Republic of China, PRC, is committing genocide and crimes against humanity against Uyghurs. So how does this translate? What is the Chinese government doing that elevates this to the level of genocide?
Well, the Chinese government, in the views of many lawyers and legal experts, breached its obligation under the Genocide Convention. Like, for example, like everything that is happening in the camps, whether the forced separation of children or causing emotional and physical harm against this population and against the people, and as well as forced sterilization of women, the torture and the political indoctrination, all of that are happening in the camps, meet the UN definition of genocide by building up these concentration camps and putting people through this unspeakable human suffering. China is indeed committing genocide.
I want to ask a little bit about your brother. Tell our audience who he was and why it is that he is in a Chinese prison today.
You know, my brother is my best friend. I love him dearly. He's a wonderful dance partner, son, and a friend, but also somebody who truly believed in the power of technology and how it can advance and provide opportunities for many young and upcoming musicians, artists, writers. So if you provided a platform, basically, a combination of a lot of social media platforms like Facebook or the New York Times or CNN. So you do have this networking features, but as well as you can actually have access to news, columns, and even Chinese laws that you can read about. But in addition, at his core, he's very much committed to philanthropy. So he provided, he engaged in a lot of philanthropic commitment concerning kids with disabilities, elderly, or survivors of sexual violence. Because of all of that, he was invited to participate in the State Department's very prestigious program that have produced many world leaders, including the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, who at the moment is attending the Olympic in China. And yet my brother's fate could not be further apart from them. And because of him being an intellectual, and just because he was Uyghur and he came to the United States, they put him in the concentration camps. He disappeared within weeks after returning from the U.S.
So we reached out to the Chinese embassy about him, and they pointed us to a statement that they gave back in 2020 to ABC News, where they said, Chinese citizen Ekpar Asat was sentenced to 15 years in prison on conviction of inciting to splitting the country. He confessed to his crime and is serving the sentence in good health. He was convicted because he violated the law of China, and this has nothing to do with if he attended a certain activity in the United States or not.
You know, the charges change repeatedly. The initial charge was inciting ethnic hatred and ethnic discrimination. And I pointed out how a member of ethnic group was systematically oppressed by the state can commit ethnic discrimination against the majority, who is by definition is his oppressor. I think as a result of that, they now change it to a new crime, which is inciting splittism. Now, the Chinese government couldn't point to single evidence that supports its claim, but yet they're just so hastened to change the crime as they please. And that speaks volume as to the justice system, what kind of justice system and rule of law Chinese government has. And this is nothing but a travesty of justice.
Do you have access to your brother? Does your family get to see your brother?
That is the whole mockery of the justice system itself. For almost 5 years, my parents didn't have any access to him. They couldn't even visit him or see him. They didn't even know where he's being held. Only until after I became a public advocate for him, the Chinese government was forced to showcase him in some sort of what is called proof of life video. And this only took place almost 5 years after he forcibly disappeared. And in that video, he looked gone. He looked like a shadow of his former self. In fact, he's held in solitary confinement since January 2019. Now, under the international law, if you hold somebody for more than 14 days under solitary confinement, that is a definition of torture.
Are you concerned that your advocacy on his behalf could make life more difficult for your parents or other relatives who are still in the province?
I'm always concerned. And I think that is the far, the long arm reach of the Chinese government. Even here in the US, that I can never be free, because you're always self-censoring yourself. You're walking this really fine line and trying to understand where you want to be very firm in your advocacy, but you also don't want to do more harm by putting your family in danger. And, you know, nobody should live a life like that. You know, you're constantly calculating, is this strong enough? Can I demand from me? And I should be able to do that as an advocate, as a sister, as a family member. But at the same time, like, the Chinese government often retaliates against people who speak up. And I'm always worried about him. Would he be tortured every time I speak? In fact, right now, speaking to you, he's in my mind, what's going to happen to him. But the truth shines, and I must speak up. If I don't, the world wouldn't know what has happened to him. And I want to make sure that the world knows his fine name, his story, but as well as what's happening to the millions innocent like him.
Do you ever feel guilty? I mean, here you are having a conversation with me after having a career in law. You're safe and sound, and yet your parents are kind of in this weird limbo where they have one child who's safe and one child who they know hardly anything about anymore.
Survivor's guilt is a real thing. I think I'm a survivor, but I'm also a fighter. And I am very much reminded of that every day he spends in the Chinese government's concentration camps. It reminds me that I narrowly escaped from the very the same camps that my brother is suffering right now. Just imagine for a second, I could be in that camps. And I think that intimate understanding of my fate is what fuels me to be his advocate. So yeah, it's a guilt as well as just an immense responsibility.
So why do you think it is that if the U.S. State Department agrees that there is a genocide that is underway, that we even decide to not have diplomatic ties, a diplomatic boycott during this Olympics, But why do we go forward? Why do we, and all the other nations that are there right now, why do they engage in this Olympics if something so egregious is happening?
Well, I think China's overwhelming economic influence dictates today's outcome. Many countries are reluctant to engage even in diplomatic boycott, let alone sending the athletes to excel while many people are locked up in the prison camps. I think the International Olympic Committee has been so disgraceful. And Thomas Bash, who is the senior executive of the Olympics, actually said that they don't want to get in between two parties, the Chinese government and Uyghurs. Let's set the record straight. This is not two state actors who are engaged in some sort of dispute. This is, it's not even dispute. It's a crackdown between a powerful state actor against people who have no agency whatsoever.
I want to get your reaction to this statement from the IOC. It says, the IOC has neither the mandate nor the capability to change the laws or the political system of a sovereign country. Given the diverse participation in the Olympic Games, the IOC must remain neutral on all global political issues. Is this a global political issue?
This is not a global and political issue. This is a human rights issue. This is a humanitarian crisis. And in fact, if anything, the IOC is actually politicizing and taking side of the oppressor. And for me, that is a political choice that they're making. They're not making a humanitarian decision based on massive and unspeakable and immeasurable human suffering that is taking place. IOC has been very much complicit in the aftermath of Peng Shuai's star tennis player's enforced disappearance. And now, like her, she's totally walking back all of her allegations. And the IOC is there to orchestrate this whole campaign. So no, I think if anything, the IOC is complicit in the Chinese government whitewashing the genocide and totally claiming its legitimacy while the entire world is watching.
When people watched the opening ceremony, they saw that the torch was lit by someone with a Uyghur last name. And I think she's a cross-country skier. And so when you heard that news, what did you think?
Well, I was still in a bit of disbelief. Like, I knew that the Chinese government would, you know, put forward some sort of like a showcase, but I wasn't expecting that an honor of such magnitude would be given to Uyghur torchbearer. If this is a different timeline, it could have been a moment of pride and celebration for the Uyghur community as well as China. Only if China is a country that celebrates pluralism and diversity. But it's not a selection executed in good faith. It's a deliberate choice. It's a provocative choice while the Chinese government is being accused of committing ethnic cleansing and a genocide and crimes against humanity to the Uyghur population. It is trying to showcase that the Uyghurs are not tortured. Uyghurs do have these opportunities. And I actually compared to this to the Berlin Olympics where Helene Mayer, where like she was forced to deliver a Nazi salute. And she later claimed that it may have saved her family. And you can see from the initial rollout of her and this whole grand gesture to the point of how her family was captured in that moment, celebrating her, all of that is part of the propaganda campaign to paint a different narrative as to what's happening in Xinjiang. But in some ways, I also took it as a reactionary move. We put the Chinese government on defense, that it has to respond.
When you turn on the Olympics tonight, you see no shortage of global companies, American companies, still advertising at these games. What goes through your mind when you see that corporate support is still strong?
You know, one thing I need to highlight is that American companies are eager to tout their values on racial equity and justice when it serves its interests. In America, it's trendy to stand up for oppressed community, whether the Black Lives Matter or the controversial Georgia's voting laws and such. But when it comes to China, if they do speak the truth, then they would be cut off from this massive and lucrative economy and the market. Hence, they couldn't uphold the values they so proclaim to be in the United States. So we see a lot of double standard from the American companies. And, you know, it's really disheartening to see that, because American companies, at the end of the day, they are incorporated under the U.S. law. And not being complicit in genocide should be the basic norms of ethical business. But that's not the kind of practice that we're seeing right now.
Yale Law Fellow and human rights attorney Rehan Assad, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And we continue to keep the spotlight on massive abuses of human rights, the treatment of Uyghurs in China, and on the struggle to preserve democracy and press freedom around the world. That is it for now. If you ever miss our show, you can find the latest episode shortly after it airs on our podcast. You can find it at cnn.com/podcast and all major platforms. Just search for Amanpour or scan the QR code on your screens now. Remember, you can always catch us online. Thank you for watching, and goodbye from London.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.